is Absolute Rally, powered by the Kielder Works team. Cordless tools tailored for the world of motorsport.
Hello everyone, welcome to Absolute Rally, episode 9, season 13. I have got one more episode to go before I can run away and not speak to these three reprobates for at least 2 weeks. And believe you me, I can't wait. But anyway, I'll say on my right, hello Trevor Agnew.
Hello, Tony Simpson, thanks for the invitation, it sounds wonderful.
Oh, it's alright, it's fine. And in the middle, I will say hello Jack Bennion.
Hello, I'm in the middle, I like it.
Yeah, you're the sandwich.
Piggy Bennion in the middle.
Yeah, before we go any further, how are your blisters?
I haven't got any.
Having you? There you go, you see.
Wore
the right socks. Well done. Cracking time, by the way. All joking aside. Very, very impressive. The only thing that is not as impressive, and maybe it's the fact that, because I'm lacking it, what the hell was going on with that haircut you've got going on there? It looks like you've got a dead sparrow just placed on your head.
It didn't combine very well with 2 hours and 58 minutes of running, I'll admit that much.
What was your time, Jack?
2 hours and 58 minutes.
Yeah, he's not mentioned it before. And on my left, I'll say hello, Ryan Champion.
Hello. I think it was just under 3 hours.
It was just under 3 hours. I think he made the point it was just under 3 hours. 120 seconds just under, in case you're wondering. If we're going to talk facts, by the way, should we do some Gary Boyd ones? Because we didn't do any last week.
Yeah,
go for it.
Let's do for it. The last time WRC competed in Turkey was 2010. However, the last time WRC's top competitors were in Turkey was in December 2012. Can your fellow hosts explain why?
It was the FIA Awards.
You have to up your game here, Gary Boyd. Yeah.
Boom!
Boom. There you go. Just a mic drop moment. Don't you be saying Trevor, boom.
Trevor Agnew kills it.
Yeah, well you played. You can't be saying that. Other award winners to be acknowledged that night were... Any guesses who else won that night?
Other than who?
Other than Sebastian Loeb and Daniel Elner. Who else won titles that year?
Sebastian Vettel.
Sebastian Vettel. it's got a bit of a there was a bit of a local feel to it, and I'll explain why. Elvin Evans, WRC Academy.
Yep.
He's not local to Turkey, though.
And SWRC was Craig Breen.
Ah.
Mm. Yeah. And Benito Guerra.
Yeah.
PWR. Was that the last year of PWRC? Must have been, wasn't it? 2012. Don't know. Gary Boyd. He knows now. So there you go. So there's some Turkey facts for you. Speaking of Turkey, we are going to talk Turkey. Right, I've got a bit of an interesting one for you here, boys, because I've had a look at the entry list, right, and normally this would be like in any other business one. I could imagine Ryan Champion doing this one for any other business, but Henning Solberg's back. We were talking about brothers the other week, but Henning Solberg is back, the Solbergs we did indeed forget, and there was many others which people tweeted in. Thank you very much for that. The Sprongles was the last one that came in, by the way, the Canadians. There you go. Anyway, we digress. But Henning Solberg's actually in a Skoda Fabia R5, which surprised me. Right.
Did Sweden in an R5 last year.
Yeah, in a Skoda, was it?
Yeah.
Was it? Right. Okay. All right. I didn't remember. I don't know, more so of late, I always think of them in a Fiesta. But what is our connection to that particular Skoda? That car, that registration number. Don't Google it. Any ideas, boys?
Is it Can you tell us what the registration number is?
Is it a Toxport car?
Well done, Ryan Champion.
Is it Chris Ingram's?
It's the car that Chris has used all year. Yeah.
Yeah.
So
what car is Chris using then?
He's using a new one.
Okay.
Yeah. They're obviously not sharing it. That's a bit awkward. Chris is in. Let's find Chris's car, shall we?
I think Chris is in the one he had at Goodwood, isn't he?
No. No. That the car at Goodwood was the one that Henning's in now. SP0447 is the registration number of that one. So, anyway, just thought to put it out there. I thought it was quite an interesting one. I can imagine Ryan Champion doing that as in any other business.
But, it was written down just in case you hadn't We haven't brought it up when we got that far.
I quite like
this. This is like two things, isn't it?
I quite like this one because his registration number of this one is AWTS156. Now, AWS are my initials, and TS, of course, is the short version. So there you go. Come on, Chris, bring it home. It's got my name on. Not a great start, really, to a podcast, this one, is it? I didn't think it was either. You'll be relieved to know, boys, that a bit later on the podcast, it actually gets so much better because we've got, what was his official title, right? Because I had to check it out at the beginning, really, because I couldn't
quite. Team director.
Team director of Hoonigan Racing, which is.
Maybe Hoonigan.
Hoonigan. Yeah. That's what I said.
No, you said Hoonan.
I did. I said Hoonigan.
Let's listen back to it.
All right, we'll listen to it. Obviously. All right, we will do. But anyway, Derek Dornish is joining us, and we talk.
What did he say, Jack?
I'm not getting in the middle of your stubble.
Right. This is not going to be great stuff to listen back to. That's all I'm going to say to you. Right, this is.
Should we move on?
Yeah, please. Anyway, Derek Dornish is on the podcast a bit later on.
Scornsy.
He's on the podcast a bit later on, and we talk all about his time with Mitsubishi and with RED and a few other bits and pieces. And there's some great stories from Mitsubishi days, and the levels of honesty that he displays, we've just been talking about before we started recording this, is astonishing. And do sit back and at least think, well, once these four are finished, there's something good coming. So there you go, boys. It's Turkey this weekend, as we've just been making reference to before. The obvious question is, I've been watching some of the videos. I watched, we record this on Thursday, Shakedown Times. I think the last lot I seen, Tanak had gone quickest, but he said, right, I think this is possibly the understatement of the year. It's a bit rough.
All the pictures we've seen from the recce are of people with punctures, aren't they? Particularly the people who didn't have maybe the proper recce cars on standard tyres. They've been struggling to literally keep four black things on their recce cars. So, it's going to be a tough weekend. I think it'll be good. I think it'll spice it up. I think they normally, WRC, particularly the teams, know all the rallies very well, and they're very well prepared for it. So I think it's nice to see, all right, it's not a brand new event, but a little bit of unknown thrown into the mix.
Trev, did you do the old Rally Turkey by any chance? Was that one? I'm not going to go on EWRC.com, even though it is where all the answers are. But as you're here, I thought I'll ask you, have you done Turkey before?
Yeah, did it in 2005 with Mark Higgins, part of production PWRC. We ran second for most of the rally, like you just mentioned. We got a couple of punctures. And then on the last stage, which was used for the first time, on a downhill section, big wide road, left-hander, just ran out of room about 80 miles an hour, heading for a telegraph pole on my door, managed to put it last minute, caught the back wheel. And even though we're on the stage, I think, for about 45 minutes, we got it out. But yeah, that was it.
Jack, have you had a go at Turkey?
Very good.
No, that's what I've thought.
No, I've never been to Rally Turkey or competed on it. No.
All joking aside, Jack, from a journalistic point of view, when we get a new event like this, and I know obviously David goes out and everything else on WRC, is there a little bit more excitement in the office at the likes of MN and Autosport because there is so much unknown that potentially is to talk about?
There's definitely a bit of intrigue, and obviously it depends on the event. I think the interesting part about this event is how rough it is, and we've already heard Jari Matalatvila saying that there's rocks the size of footballs, so it sounds like it's going to be a pretty interesting event for the drivers. But something we're always talking about and something we're always calling for is for the WRC to be more of a test, isn't it? You know, we're always talking about the glory days and hoping that the Safari Rally is going to come back at some point, and we're going to get some proper tests. And you know, whatever you say about this event, however you look at it, it's definitely going to be a test for the cars and the drivers, and there's going to be a high rate of attrition, I think, over the course of this weekend. So it's interesting to see how it's going to affect the title battle. I think that's the most interesting part. Is are Sebastian Ogier or Thierry Neuville going to be hit by any sort of problems, and Oit Tanak as well?
Right. Do you think the fact that the announcement that Thierry has got a new deal with Hyundai this week, obviously leading up to this event, does that help? Does that relax him leading into this event, do you think? Do you think it was ever in question? Is probably the. I don't think it ever was.
No, I don't think so. And I also think he's, you know, he'll be so focused on the battle for the world championship that, it's probably nice to put pen to paper and something less to worry about. But no, I don't think come the rally it would really make any difference. He has got a fantastic chance at the world championship. The team are performing very well. He's performing very well, and he's very focused on the rally ahead. By the way, Turkish Airlines do have a nice lounge in the airport in Istanbul.
Right, there you go. If you are travelling at the moment, and
nice library with a pool table in it.
A library with a pool table in.
Yeah, okay. It's very nice. Yeah.
So it's meant to be quiet in a library. All you're going to get is people just banging balls, which is never good. It's never a good noise wherever you are. If you're hearing that and you're not part of the action, it's never good. Trev, do you see this event as the one that, you know, I watched the preview last night and you know, there's a lot. We've been fighting silly season, but there's so many people now that feel that after Turkey, everything, you know, domino effect is going to happen. Do you see it happening that way?
Yeah, it's a good excuse to get up early on Friday morning, because the first conventional stage is 38 kilometres long. So how do you play that one? If it's as rough as everybody's going to say, you know, what pace do you go at? You could potentially see a lot of gaps at the end of that stage. No doubt there are going to be issues on it. I'd imagine as well. But what a way to start a brand new rally or new notes for everybody. That for me is the most exciting part of it, seeing what's going to happen at that point.
What a great test, Jack, for the juniors. And you know, I think David Evans has made reference to it in his column this week, but having worked with some of the juniors and know some of the juniors I spoke to before they went out there, this I'm kind of slightly conflicted on the fact that, is this a great place to be sending an R2 car? As around the Junior World Championship, but equally, I'll come back and counter my own argument and say, well, it is, because it makes them think about the driving more and not necessarily being flat out everywhere.
Yeah, it's going to be a difficult test for them. And the other thing, I guess, is, you know, with there being higher chance of breaking roll bars and things like that, there's a bit more work for them to potentially do on the car in the road sections and stuff like that. So gambling on what parts to take in the car and how heavy you want to make the car and stuff as well. So yeah, there's a lot of different aspects of the event that are going to be that is going to be testing for a junior. Have to admit, when I saw it on the calendar, I thought that's a little attempt by the WRC maybe to try and boost the entries for the event. But I think it's a brilliant test for the juniors, and I think, you know, whatever the motivation behind it, it's a great event for them to go and do. And any junior championship should be doing any round of the WRC really, because it's experience for, you know, for them for the future.
No, I'll take that, but I think, Rai, where I was at a dilemma, I was thinking, well, you know, this is going to be tough. You know, the world cars are through, then you've got obviously WRC two cars, and then you've got, you know, your little front wheel drive Fiesta R2Ts, which, you know, I've got an R2, I haven't got an R2T, but I'm not entirely sure I'd want to fancy following that lot on a rough rally.
It'll be an absolute minefield. You know, that's what we don't see a lot of footage of on WRC. Any of the footage we see on TV is always of the front running cars, which have the best of the conditions. And yes, second time through, sometimes, you know, they do have ruts in places, but it's nothing like what it is after they've passed through twice. Even our own Rally GB can have, you know, fairly deep ruts, but out there with all the rocks we're seeing, it will be incredibly rough. So, yeah, you're quite right. It's particularly tough on the likes of the R2 cars, and I think the winner of the juniors this weekend will be one that drives very, very sensibly, that doesn't go out and sets the pace on the first stage. It'll be somebody who picks a way through and tries to avoid problems.
I couldn't agree more. And the battle in WRC2, Trev, is equally as interesting as well. Obviously, they've got slightly more about them than the little R2 cars, but we've got the, you know, the main Skoda boys there. We've got Pontus Tiedemann and we've got Jan Kopecky. Now, whether Pontus does any more, whether he, because obviously the story is still floating around about him being in the Polo for Sardinia. Is it Sardinia? Or am I getting mixed up?
I've not heard anything about Tiedemann. This Solberg is being rumoured for Spain, with Camelli confirmed for Spain as well.
Camelli is confirmed, but I'm I've heard that it's Tiedemann that's going
to
be doing.
Yeah, we're all expecting Tiedemann to be in there at some point, aren't we? He's definitely going to be doing a round at some point.
Yeah, I think so. Anyway, the point I was going to make to Trev. Obviously, we've got the Skoda Motorsport Works team there. We've got the M Sport boys there. We've got Motorsport. It's for a rally that we've just been saying is going to be a rally of attrition. It's actually got an incredibly strong WRC2 entry, which I found really, really surprising because, you know, it is going to be notoriously tough and notoriously probably expensive for those outside of the works team setup, as we keep talking about, because the R5 car isn't the cheapest thing in the world to run. And you just find it quite hard to believe that somebody's prepared to put one through there and have the repair bill at the end there, I guess.
Yeah, it's, I've seen stronger as regards WRC and two entries. As you say, they've got the two work Skodas and they'll just keep firing parts at it every service. Gus Greensmith, probably the same. And then Titanovich, I suppose, they'd have a good budget to run with it. They like a Chris. I don't know what his situation will be, Chris Ingram. So, again, an event like this, you know, I just, when you were talking earlier about the Junior World Championship, I don't agree with it, sending junior cars to really rough events. It doesn't achieve much for me. I want to see junior drivers absolutely flat out against each other. This learning how to control the pace and all of that, you can do that later. I want to see the quickest guys. So, WRC2, it's going to be interesting because you've got Tiedemann and Kopechke going head-to-head, I think, for the first time this year, both in the shout of the championship. A little bit more of a level playing field for Kopechke because of the nature of the roads. So that's going to be fascinating to see how that one unfolds.
Predictions. Yeah, I think so. Let's do predictions.
You okay. Go first, Tony.
I am going to go. Let me have a little look. I'm probably going to go left field, and I'm going to go because of road position and everything else. I'm going to go Hayden Paddon.
Interesting.
There you go. Okay. There you go.
I'll go OJ.
Okay. Right. Ryan Champion?
I am also going to go Sebastian Ogier. Sensible head.
JB. Okay.
Tough.
Trevor Agnew?
I'm definitely going to go Ogier simply because the Ford is going to be the most reliable it traditionally is. And I'd even suggest that Elvin Evans will get in the podium if he drives the same sort of pace and keeps out of trouble. And what's to say that Sunderland can't be up there as well?
Okay.
But I would put Paddon in the middle. So let's go. I'll go Ogier, Paddon and Evans.
It's funny enough what we've just been talking about, of course, about the works teams and everything else. But Hyundai needs more pace. Michel Nandan is seen the advantage diminish over the last few events and obviously want more pace.
Yeah, you've got to be worried by Toyota's performance if you're another manufacturer, haven't you, over the past few rallies. We've seen Oi Tanak especially seems to have come to the fore with the mixture of that car, and you know, Tanak even saying that he wasn't happy on some of the rallies with the pace of the Toyota. So it seems like there's a little bit more to come from Oi and Toyota in terms of maximising what they can do together, and the run they've been on. I think the thought that Oi might not be absolutely 100% happy in that car and the results that he's had with that is quite worrying for the other manufacturers. So I think we always get to this point in the season where Hyundai are chasing up, don't we? They're always coming out to say, you know, we're not quite happy with this or we're not quite happy with that. And, you know, you'd be surprised if any of the manufacturers weren't working very hard at this minute to improve the pace mid-season to, you know, finish the running strong and really go for the championships.
Okay. I'll tell you one thing, just slightly left field from following on from what Jack's just been saying. I watched the preview of the event and on WRC Plus yesterday, and what was interesting, right, is that they were asking the drivers about the silly season thing, which we've debated for weeks on end now, but Andreas Mikkelsen was the only one who, and it's just interesting. He was under contract, obviously. Thierry's now under contract as well, but Andreas Mikkelsen was the one that was talking about Chris Meek. He was saying, you know, Chris Meek's still around and people are going to be, you know, he's going to be getting a seat, or, you know, watch it. You'll see what I mean. But out of all the drivers, he was adamant that Chris was still there or thereabouts for a seat.
It'll be interesting to watch it, actually. Well, let's hope he is, and I'm sure he's trying to keep a foot in the door. We know just how fast he is, so I mean, it's good to hear other drivers talking about him still, because he needs to be talked about, or else you quickly get forgotten, don't you? So I don't know. We'll have to wait and see, won't we?
We will. Trev,
I still think it's unlikely, but let's hope so.
Yeah. Trev, Malcolm Wilson coming out back in. Elving, you've just mentioned him, obviously, in your predictions there as well. Hasn't had a great season, but Malcolm coming out and backing it. He can't do anything else, really, can he? He's got to try and support him for at least the remainder of the year to try and support, to get manufacturer points as much as anything.
Yeah, of course, and he's invested a lot in Elvin as well over the years. So, encouraging, making sure that as I said, if he runs at the same sort of pace that he's run that this year, and stays out of trouble, he'll be in with a very good chance of a result in this one. I'll just go back to the reliability that I have of them sporting Toyota. Of course, they're going back to the previous engine because it's a paired event, so therefore they can't use the Evo engine that they've been using in the last couple of events. So. And again, it's a high temperature event, and also some of the stages are a little bit high. There's altitude in some of them, so the issues that they had in Mexico over the last couple of years could resurface. But they reckon they're convinced they've sorted that. Hyundai have reliability issues that we saw even today in the shakedown with Mickelson stopping the transmission problems. We'll find out tomorrow morning. The speculation will stop in a few hours.
I'm sure it will, but people probably listen to this retrospectively, so I'm sure they'll put us straight next week. But we've just been talking about Chris Meek, Jack, and you guys. Obviously, it's common knowledge now, but Chris is back for the Rally Legends outing in one of Colin McRae's old cars. Be interesting to see him back in a Citroen, oddly enough.
Yeah, I'm sure if he could pick any car, he probably wouldn't pick a Citroen at this point, would he? But yeah, it'd be nice to see him have a little spin, and I'm sure he'll enjoy the event. There's a lot of good people going to be there. Mikko Hirvonen and Craig Breen will be there as well, so I'm sure he'll enjoy getting back out in a rally car, and hopefully a reporter can corner him and get some quotes from him on what he thinks of his Citroen loss of seat and what he's going to do for next year.
Very much so. Okay, but listen, before we go over to the middle section with Derek and all the stories from way back when, I just want to very quickly, Jack, you've got 2 and 3 this week in MN, and we go parochial, and it's the rejig for the radical rejig, as you call it in your headline, of the British Rally Championship calendar. I've read the story and I knew about the calendar probably before you published it, if truth be told. And I'm interested. You tell our listeners about it, and I want to hear what the boys think about it, and then I'll tell you where I got to with it.
Yeah, it's an interesting one. They've dropped Rally GB and Rally Isle of Man for next year. We've talked about Rally Isle of Man on previous shows, haven't we? It's always been a cornerstone of the BRC, or has been for a long time, but the recent problems on the island and the politics problems and the event organisational problems have led to the event being cancelled this year, and lots of question marks over it. So the BRC have gone in a bit of a different direction. They've gone with the Cambrian Rally to start the year, which is a North Wales event in Llandudno, which is a round of the Welsh and the BTRDA Rally Championships, and then another new event to go to after that is West Cork in Ireland, which I know a lot of people in Ireland are getting very excited about the opportunity to have a few more R5 cars out there, and then the Pirelli keeps its place at the end of April. And then Ypres stays in also, and the Ulster there, they keep their places in June and August. And then the Galloway Hills Rally in September is the closing round. And that probably sounds like, I don't know really. I don't know outside of sort of my way of viewing things, what people think, but the Galloway Hills sounds like the sort of most unusual choice on that calendar from the outside of things. But when you actually talk to people who've done the event, and talk to people who know the organisers and stuff like that, it's regularly touted as one of the best events in the country. So very pleased to see that getting a chance. It's an event that's worked hard on its organisation and has brilliant stages and have been rewarded by coming into the BRC. So yeah, it's an interesting calendar. I think the idea of sharing more rounds with Ireland is potentially a good thing for attracting a few more R5 entries if they can get them. I think GB, however you look at it, was probably a bit of a step too far in terms of adding a lot of cost over a short period of time and a lot of time away from work. And I think the organisers have tried to lower the amount of time away from work needed to do the calendar. So, yeah, I can see positives and negatives. I'm sure all your guys will have your own opinion on what the calendar looks like.
There you go. Trevor Agnew, can I get your thoughts on it as a former competitor and now obviously a pundit, dare I say?
I think it's different nowadays in that most people, as you said, work, and it's an incredible number of days. I remember about this time last year, somebody added up the number of days that they'd be off work if they did the championship, and it was something like 27, which is a huge amount of time. I see as well that they're touting with running the Ulster as a one-day rally. The Pirelli is a one-day rally, and that makes sense to me. Geographically, the Pirelli and the Galloway Hills are quite close together. But as Jack said, the Galloway Hills rally is a cracking event. I've competed on it once with Chris Meek, actually, the second of a rally. But they use a lot of the stages that we used to use in the Scottish rally, big, wide, fast roads, which are brilliant. So a good mix of events and being realistic, you know, the type of people that you want to attract to the championship. You know, they can get there on a Friday and leave again Saturday night if they want to. And that certainly cheapens the cost from service crews and accommodation and everything that goes with it. So for me, it makes sense.
Ryan Champion.
I think it's good that there's been a shake-up, because we seem to talk about it every week. Whether it'll bring back the entries that it much needs, I don't know. We'll have to wait and see. But funnily enough, as Trev just alluded to there, some of us, you know, there may be different rallies, but it's very traditional British Rally Championship territory. We used to always start the championship with the Rally of Wales, which was traditionally held in the forests of North Wales. So now we've got the Cambrian there. And again, just echo what the other guys have just said on the Galloway Hills. Fantastic rally. I've done it in the past and been up to the rally a few times, and always a great atmosphere around it. Good stages, all wide and fast, Trev, apart from Dalbeattie, which I seem to remember was the opposite.
Funny, the story of Dalbeattie was the first stage, as I say, that year I sat with Chris Meek. And at the end of it, he could hardly talk through laughing. And, you know, as you say, it's quite a tricky stage. The stone's right up to the side of the road. It took us out in the Astra in 2000, the first stage. We retired from the rally, took a wheel off it. But, you know, his first time in a rally car, second time in a rally car. And he says, somebody's gave me this rally car to have this much fun. You know, that's the Chris Meek that we've seen at the end of stages as well, right the way up until this year. And when he's in that mood, it's fantastic. But Dalbeattie is the tricky one, yeah.
Right. And I think Rally GB, we all know that it, when you've got a championship that isn't thriving with numbers, to put such an expensive rally in, yes, in an ideal world, having Rally GB in the British Championship would be great, but nobody can afford to do it realistically, so I think it had to go.
Boys, we're at the point where we're going to go to a break. We're going to sit back and relax and listen to Tales with Derek Dorsey, and then we're going to come back with our end of the business.
This is Absolute Rally, powered by the Kielder Works team. Cordless tools tailored for the world of motorsports, developed from hands-on knowledge that you only get in the service park, not the boardroom. Kielder create products for their own use and like-minded people, those inspired by mechanical motion and engineering. Plus, exclusively for Absolute Rally listeners, use discount code RALLY for 10% off at www.kielder.co. Simply search Kielder Tools online.
Welcome back to the next section of Absolute Rally. And again, we always try to mix things up. You know, obviously we have drivers, we have team managers and everything else. But we've got somebody who is got so much history, which he shares with us on Instagram. And he just happens to be, I'm going to try and get this right, Derek. Are you the team director of Hoonan Racing? Am I got that right?
Yes. Yeah. For all my troubles. Yeah. It is.
Derek Dornacy, welcome to Absolute Rally, by the way.
Thank you very much. Thanks for having me on.
No, this is brilliant. Right, before we go any further, Ryan and I were talking about this because we actually got quite excited, Derek, by having you on. And the reason why is because you post, apart from everything else you do, you post fantastic images on Instagram of Rally of Yesteryear. Now, that prompted the debate between me and Ryan of where you started your career in motorsport. I was adamant it was RED, and Ryan thought it was quad sport. So perhaps you should tell us where your career started.
Well, strangely, it was Blaze Motors quad sport. So there's a winner there.
There you go, right. Over to you. That's it. I'm out.
Yeah, so it goes right back to there. What happened was I was working in nightclubs and I wanted to get into rallying. So I basically gave up a really good job and went into rallying for all my troubles. And Blaze Motors quad sport were in Oldbury, which is in the West Midlands, not too far from where I was living. So I did some work with Peter Collinson there, who was running Kenjiro Shinazuka from Mitsubishi's factory team. And it was really interesting. It was a foot in the door. Capitalised on it, and you know, the rest is history, really. It's just flown by. I was actually in, we were looking back, and I've been in motorsport for 30 years since that, so not bad, really.
Not at all. Sorry. Well, the deal was, if I was wrong, then I would hand over to Ryan at this point to say, because that's the way it kind of works. So over to you, Ryan.
Yeah, well, I mean, I guess that was an interesting way into the sport as well, because obviously the Japanese were providing amazing homologation cars at that point and great engines, but their view of building a rally car was a little bit different to the European view, wasn't it?
Yeah, I mean, for Kenjiro, I mean, it was a massive effort. They would do three or four recce's for Safari as one standalone rally. They'd have three, four chase cars, two actual event cars, and the car was built like a tank. But as you say, you know, they were more endurance and trying to get the car to the finish. So they never had any success, unfortunately, with Safari. Toyota and Lancia were very strong at the time. So I moved on from there and went on to the factory team, and we won Safari in 96 when Kenjiro was our teammate. And, you know, having both the cars in the workshop against each other, we basically took a slightly beefed up European car, and they had a Lancer which had two floor pans on it grafted to it to try and keep it together. But we went there with a bit of a plan that we'd try and attack the event and change the suspension at every service. And, you know, it was an extremely tough build-up to the rally. It was a 10-day test there and a 7-day recce before we even started. And it was a true character-building event. And we won that event. And the Japanese were very, very happy with it. But as you say, it was two different approaches, the European way to attack an endurance event, and, you know, the Japanese build a tank to try and get it around.
But I think it's fair to say that was the first time that approach had been tried, even with the European team as well, though, wasn't it? You know, TTE had been there with tanks for the previous years, for want of a better description. And your approach with rally art, like you said, was to attack it. So that was a very different philosophy, even for the European team.
Yeah, I mean, the first day of the recce, we went out there. We didn't do, you know, by the time we got out to Kenya for the event, we hadn't done a pre-Christmas test. We hadn't done a post-Christmas test. We went there to utilise the 10-day window of time testing, really because of how busy we were with the World Championship in Monte Carlo, Sweden, and then you came straight there. So I flew from before Sweden, I think it was, across to Kenya to set everything up. We did the first day of the test with that car with a 125-litre tank in the back, and we broke the back end of the car. So that first night was, you had to really dig deep, because we'd just done a all-day testing from a 3 o'clock leave from the workshop in the morning to come back to the workshop that night, and suddenly realised that everything had to come out of the boot. We had to, I think we used 5 kilograms worth of welding wire to weld everything back up again and put everything back in. And you know, we lived the pain for those 10 days to get the car into a position where it was possible to come away with a result. And the story behind it really was that, you know, we looked at it during the test and the recce, and we could see that really the rose joint bearings in the actual suspension had only lasted probably 50 to 60 kilometers before they started to knock themselves out. So we went down that avenue, had a discussion one evening about if we changed every corner and every suspension arm, every service, then we'd have a fresh car for Tommy. Tommy liked the concept. We tried it on the last day of the recce. It seemed to work quite well. So I ordered a think it was 250 extra rows joint bearings to come out with the last people.
Wow.
And then we attacked the event that way, and probably one of our proudest moments was to win the event. The last service was a remote service, and there wasn't a dry eye there because we'd come to Kenya our first time and won the event. So it was massive for us as a team.
Now, that was with the Evo 3, but there'd been a build-up, I guess, to that point with the Gallant and the Evo 1 and Evo 2, and Rally Art and Rugby went very much from a part-time team to World Championship winners, didn't it?
Yeah, I mean, before that, we had some really good drivers before that. You know, we'd gone through the Gallant with Ari and Timo Salonen, and we came across the Lance, so we had Armin Swartz, Kenneth Eriksson again, and we'd been seen as like a specialist team. Like, we'd win Sweden Rally because it was Kenneth's home event, and you know, it was, we'd had a couple of flashes in the pans. We were pretty competitive in Monte Carlo with the Coca-Cola coloured striped cars, and we've chucked it away really. And then Rally GB that year, we'd gone through a different damper supplier because we, you know, we had some really good engineers. We were only a really small team. When I joined, I think there was 16 of us full time, and the rest were freelance. So it was a compact team. And Roland Lloyd there would always be, you know, open to actually listen to the boys, listen to the feedback from the drivers and everybody on the tests. And it was a really strong small team with a small budget, and we turned it around to make it quite successful. But as you say, leading into 96, we had, you know, results and success, but 96 we came out really strong. And you know, that year was you know, Argentina win for the first time, we'd won Sweden, you know, it was all going really well. And you know, after the end of that year, we could see Richard was going to be we wanted to go for the manufacturer's title, so Richard was looking like a good option to try and join the team. So we kind of went along in steps. We went from not doing a full championship to then attacking the full championship, and then we even went and did Hong Kong, Beijing, and did Asian Pacific. So it was bloody busy at the time, but it was a whirlwind. You started January the 1st, and then before you knew it, you were shutting up at 24th of December for the end of the year. So it just went on and on and on.
Now, you just touched on a rally there that really intrigues me, and probably a lot of our listeners won't be very familiar with it because it's outside of WRC and probably outside of the events that they've heard of. But Hong Kong Beijing, I think I've read you saying on record somewhere that it was one of your most memorable rallies, and I hear a lot of stories that a friend of mine, Mike Barker, who shared a truck with you, I think, once on Hong Kong Beijing, and Chris Birkbeck was in a gravel car there, and everybody who went to Hong Kong Beijing comes back with these amazing stories. What was it that made that rally so special?
I think the access to the country was the first thing, really. I think it actually struggled to get that kind of access now. I think there's a couple of historic rallies that do it, but we were really lucky. When you look at the whole 7-day route, starting off in Hong Kong, we actually set a base at the British Gurkha camp in Kowloon. The adjutant there was really good and let us use the facilities, and that led to a few stories actually. But we based ourselves out of there. We had 40 containers turn up. We had, I think, wow, it was 34 service vehicles to support the three cars, because Kenjiro entered that event as well as the third car. And it really was a survival event. If your truck stopped on those 7 days, you're in the middle of nowhere. You've got to then, you know, improvise on the spot and try and catch up. And the first morning, I think it was 90, I'm not sure which year it was, the first morning, the first event, the luggage truck, because we had you know, drivers and co-drivers, we had to have a luggage truck just for their luggage, because no one stopped in the same hotel each night. That broke its back axle. So on the side of the road, I was palming off bags into vehicles that went by, and we abandoned this old. We bought some Toyota Hilux. One was an ex-ambulance, still had blood on the floor, but it was, we bought some trucks just to get us through. But we lost that one truck that morning, and because I'd looked after all the logistics for all the vehicles and all the boys and all the parts, it was a kind of a, you know, heart stopping moment for about half an hour, thinking about on your feet how to get around it. But we did, and it was an unbelievable experience. You know, the worrying fact was that if you got lost on that route, you could be lost for ages. And the biggest problem we had was basically making sure we had enough fuel in the vans with a tank and to actually reach each remote refuel, because all the vans service from a particular service fuel station en route, and you had to get to that route. If you got lost, then you were, you know, wrong. You were possibly not going to make the fuel stop. So, everybody was entered in the event in theory because of the way the actual paperwork was done. And it was a fantastic challenge. We got to an overnight halt one night, and the support cars had got caught in the traffic. It wasn't really traffic; it was just volumes of people walking into the city to see the event. And Ari actually hit his door, and there was only myself and three of the mechanics there. And Ari actually helped repair the door and refuel all three cars. That's how good he was on the event. So it was a survival event, really. It was but what you saw on those 7 days was just astonishing. It was it was when you drove everywhere, it was like the aliens landing, because people just stared at you all the time because they'd never seen Westerners before. It was a really unique event.
So very different to what we see with current world rallies. But you said there about Richard joining the team, and you know, by the following year with the Evo 4, as it was then, the Radley Art team started to become this WRC steamroller. What brought such success? And I guess obviously the big rival at the time was the ProDrive team.
Yeah, I mean, it was we'd struggled really with consistency, and when we actually ran Tommy in San Remo the first event, and I flew straight from San Remo to Hong Kong, Beijing, and Tommy had been really quick on the pre-event test, and on the first stage of the event, we'd always been the almost people, you know, we pulled out these flash in the pan results. We would never really made it consistent, and then Tommy came along, and Andrew Cowan had got a really good relationship with him, and I think Tommy liked the way the team was quite compact. He'd been to some tests, he'd seen how we worked, and he came to San Remo, and he was so quick, it was astonishing, and he led the event after two stages, and then he just literally cut a corner, and he tore the lower wishbone on the front in half, and he retired. And but you could see that, you know, if we could take him on board, he was going to take us to another level. And the strange thing is you need a change within the team to push the team. And that impetus that when Tommy joined, we just, you know, we got a grip of the Evo 3, and we were ready then to take on another person. And Richard was definitely the right person to come along. And very sad what happened with Richard. I got on extremely well with him and Robert. And he came on board. We had some interesting times to start with, to learn the Mitsubishi way. But what a fantastic character. But he gave us that leverage to win the manufacturer's title in 98.
Slightly off topic, but you said that Tommy was a very motivating factor when he came into the team. When Toyota chose Tommy to lead their current team now, you know, there were some raised eyebrows, but would what you saw in Tommy maybe have led you to believe that he would be very successful with the Toyota World Rally team, as he ultimately has been over the last couple of years?
I think you could never say really what he was going to be like as a team principal until you've actually been put in that position. But what I can say is that, you know, I've been put in different positions, and you either sink or swim. And if anybody was going to swim, it would be Tommy, because his drive and determination, you know, watching him on the rallies, watching how he prepared. He would basically put a team of people around himself to make sure he could get the job done. He had Lassie Lampe, the test driver, and, you know, Lassie would get the settings right on the car before Tommy got in. So it would always be Lassie, the second driver, and then Tommy on the test, three-day test. And he'd have his gravel crew, and he'd have Pertti Sihkonen and his physio, and he'd have Matti Arilla, who was basically, you know, he used to put him to sleep at night time, but he was basically, you know, my motivation. And all the way along, you know, he could see he needed those people in place to give him. And of course, you know, he's told many people he went out on stages, he'd win the stage times, and then he'd come in, and then he'd hand the car to us and expect us to turn the car around and get it back out on time. So Yes, I can see why he's been successful, but one of the reasons he is successful, I think, is because he's seen rallying at a different era. He's seen rallying when you are on the side of the road service and you are having to react. And I think that still carries forward today, you know, that whatever you see, you know, you've got to be able to change your operation around or make things work and work off hoof. So, you know, at the time, it was a let's see how he goes, but I'm not surprised he's been successful and he's driving the team forward now and picked some good drivers.
Just picking up what you've just been saying about, you know, the mind management side and stuff like that, that's something now which, you know, is almost deemed to be revolutionary, but we're talking about something 21, 22 years ago. Did you know of any other drivers at the time that went to those levels?
No, not really. And I still think now that there's a certain amount, I won't name them, there's some drivers that are current that could really do with some assistance in that area. Because at the end of the day, you know, we as a team, we basically, it doesn't matter whether you prepare for 9 months, 12 months, you know, Safari was a 12-month preparation. You get to the event, you do all the testing, you do all the wrecking, you hand the car over to the driver, he leaves the service, he's on his Jack Jones. If he doesn't perform, everybody's watching him. And the pressure that's physically on the driver from a physical point of view is one thing, but from a mental side, it's far more demanding for them if they aren't feeling like that first morning of a rally, or if something goes wrong and people can't come on board and give them the support they need to turn it around, or just, you know, saying the right thing at the right time just to get back on track.
It's something which, you know, we have Trevor Agnew on the program as well, and it's something that we've kind of covered at length. But Tommy, I remember talking to Mark James about this, and whether you can confirm or deny this, but when Mark James was doing the coverage for the BBC and he'd go and talk to Tommy, there'd be always there was a, what's the best way of putting this, Tommy chose how good his English was, whether he wanted to talk to him or not. I'm paraphrasing ever so slightly. If you are listening, Mark, you know, you told us the story on the podcast, but he used to kind of trick Tommy where he'd ask him how lunch was and things like that, and Tommy would light up, and then all of a sudden he'd talk to him for probably 3 or 4 minutes and then possibly perhaps lose interest, or perhaps in his own mind maybe run out of a little bit of English accidentally on purpose so he didn't have to maybe commit too much to doing that side of things. Was that something that he did purposely because he didn't really want to get too sucked into the press side of it? He just wanted to be in his own place?
Yeah, I think partly that. I'll tell you the interesting way I look at it, and I look back at it now with, you know, you have a lot more time afterwards than you do at the time, but Mark always had the right way of starting the conversation off with Tommy. But you've got to remember that back in that era, we had so many more journalists on events than what there are now. So, and the strange thing is, it goes back to even Juhar and basically Marku. The you know, the journalists ask the same question. So if you come back to service, there's not much more that can be said or asked without it becoming repetitive. So Mark was always really good at trying to manipulate Tommy into feeling relaxed and think about, you know, more than yes, it was slippy or it wasn't slippy, or the conditions were rough or they weren't rough. So and if you look at it, you know, the same with Kimi Raikkonen. You know, Kimi came across to rallying. I got on really well with him, strangely, because of Kai Lindstrom, and we almost did a deal to run them, but him and Ken in their two car team, believe it or not, but for the last just fraught at the last minute, but that would have been really cool. But Kimi's very similar to Tommy. I think that they can just get fed up of the repetitiveness of the press side when there's nothing really can be discussed. So yeah, Mark did a good job.
Just before we move away from kind of that era, would you say that, and I know the benefit of hindsight, I'm probably posing this question, but the Richard and Tommy pairing at Mitsubishi Rally Art was perhaps the most balanced and probably the most successful, really, wasn't it?
Yeah, I mean, it was. Tommy came in. Tommy's ultra quick.
Richard came in and we had a revolutionary, well, not revolutionary, it was a different philosophy with a transmission where we had a sprite clutch on it, and you need to be more either 100% throttle or 100% brake. So there was no feathering the throttle or trying to feather the brakes and trying to cover it. You had to be fairly aggressive with the car, and Tommy got the most out of it. Richard struggled to start with it, and his turning point was I think New Zealand the first year we were out there, and he was struggling slightly, and I noticed that he got blisters on his hands from driving, and I said to Richard, this is crazy, this isn't right, you know, that's not what it's about, you're too tense in the car. And he agreed to change his driver position, and from a psychological point of view, he was asking this, he was asking that, and there was nothing really that, you know, he was trying to get down an avenue that wasn't going to work. So I told him that we'd basically change the TPS setting on the turbo, and thought it'd be, you know, much better for him for New Zealand. And can we bring his seat forward because his arms were too straight? He was literally holding the steering wheel with his thumbs, and he won the event. And it was a massive turning point. And again, going back to the mind thing, it was a psychological thing. It wasn't that he couldn't drive the car. It was just we had to get over that hurdle. And he never looked back after that. He was ultra quick. But what it gave us was it gave us two drivers that could win the championship straight away. You could see, you know, keep on doing what we were doing as a team, you know, that becoming world champions could be a possibility. So the balance between the both of them in the end was really, really strong.
Was it a shock when both Richard obviously went first, he went over to take the opportunity over at ProDrive, but was there also a shock a bit later on when Tommy decided to make, you know, that move?
Not really. I mean, Richard more than Tommy. If you look at it from a history point of view, you know, I think Tommy was quite keen to go into another manufacturer and be successful, and to be seen to be successful with more than Mitsubishi. But he'd been with us a long time, and you know, a change is as good as a rest, motivational wise. And it didn't surprise me that Tommy went. I think the behind the scenes there were some promises about bringing development of car, and the Japanese kind of were treading water rather than being proactive with it. So that really led to Tommy going. Richard was basically. I think Richard, in his own head, believed that we never ever at Mitsubishi favoured a driver with cars or components or service or anything. We kept it completely straight. So if one driver was getting one thing, the other driver would get it. If we didn't have enough parts, then generally we would never introduce an upgrade unless we had enough to do both cars. Richard, at one point, I think slightly was down the mindset that he was being seen as a number two driver to Tommy. I mean, Tommy was a world champion, and I think Richard felt that, you know, moved to another team and he could dominate and build that team around him, because Mitsubishi was built around Tommy, you know, because he was so successful. So that's really what led Richard to go to Subaru, and Tommy followed, you know, probably to try and see if he could better his own results with a different manufacturer, and partly because of the direction that and the lack of progress that Mitsubishi were making.
And then came the other thing which we probably forget about now, probably people of our age don't because it feels like yesterday, but there's probably generations listening to this what probably will be a little bit shocked by this, but of course you guys stayed with the Group A car a year longer than what all the other manufacturers did.
Yeah, that was really what led to the demise, really. I mean, the writing was on the wall. We got a concession from the other teams on having a longer rear damper to try and give us some more performance out of the car, but it was a band-aid, it wasn't a fix. And then what happened in the background was we were expecting the development side with new transmission and stuff that was promised from Japan. It never happened, and that kind of through the spanner in the works for us. And you know what it's like, you can't bring a new car online in 6 months, it's a 18 months at best, really, build and test and development and, you know, introduction period. So we got into that whole area of early 2000s, we were just the Japanese were just way behind on the support, and that's, you know, as you say, we were way behind. We'd been introducing the First World Rally car. That was kind of rushed, and it was a band-aid as well.
Now, that brings us to a whole different sector now, I suppose, where you went, obviously, I think it went Alistair, and I think it was Panitti.
François.
Yeah, François Delacour. Yeah. So you've got, Alistair, I could imagine to be, well, from my knowledge, Alistair's, you know, quite good fun, quite chilled. And then over the next 2 to 3 years, you had some really intense characters. I'm thinking Delacour and I'm thinking Gigi Garley.
Yeah, Delacour was interesting. François, François was with Hyundai and Alistair, so we had a swap over at after Rally GB. We had a swap over in a car park, me and Mark Busfield, with drivers, so they could get testing straight away for the new teams. And I would say, as soon as the rumour was out that François was coming to Mitsubishi, I had some really senior people phone me up and go, oh my god, you're gonna have difficulty, I'm just warning you, just be careful, it's not easy to work with, you know, all loads of stuff. And I'll be honest with you, from the very first moment he joined us, we kind of explained to him that, like, we're a family team, we've been successful this way, we want more success, you know, we'll do whatever we can. And I got on really, really well with him. And He was as much fun as Alistair, believe it or not, if not even worse. Some of the practical jokes they pulled on me were massive. And, but him and Priscilla DeBlois, his co-driver girlfriend, beautiful, nice people to be around with. And, you know, really feel sorry for François when he had the accident, you know, when he was driving that Ferrari and he had the accident and he broke his ankles. You know, he kind of set him completely back. He came to us and we had an absolute pig of a car. I won't go into it here, but even driving it around Myra and myself, it was like it just didn't work. And but to be fair to both those drivers, we hindered them massively with what we gave them. The car wasn't right in a number of areas, and it kind of had a reflection on both of their careers at that point, to be fair.
Now, fast forward on, as I say, we think about, you know, you went down the route of having this junior selection as well, where you had a fixed driver along with, I think, Danny Sola, Gigi Garley, and was it Christian Solberg as well? I think you went down the junior route. Was that kind of the last throw of the dice of just getting people driving the car and trying to get mileage into it?
It was a strange philosophy. We had the new management in the place at that time, and because you'd been there for such a long time, you'd seen what works and what doesn't work. For me, it's always been black and white. Either something works or it doesn't work. If it doesn't work, you always want to move to what does work. And if it's a case of funding, or if it's a kind of case of logistics or timing, you find a way to make it work. When the, you know, when Danny and Gigi and Christian were brought into the frame, we still had this pain in the ass car, and they developed it some more. But we it got that bad that I had a meeting with the co-drivers before each event to discuss, and I'd work out how many minutes they'd have from the end of a stage to do the refuel and get to the next in control. Because we would always have to do some repairs on the side of the road. That's how bad it got.
Wow.
And, you know, no one saw that. No one's heard of it, but that's really what was happening. And, you know, we'd have to phone Kevin Garwood, who was basically running the refuel, and ask him to keep a bay open because we were coming in really late. Or we did loads of stuff in the background to try and help the boys out. But, again, you know, because of the car wasn't competitive, or we were introducing parts on the events instead of testing them, it was a kick in the ass for us. And the new management had a directive and a direction they wanted to go down with, but, you know, to be fair, you couldn't see any light at the end of the tunnel of it.
Small world. I was talking to Kevin Garwood about an hour and a half ago about something completely unrelated to rallying, but still, you know, it is a very small world. But
it is,
especially this world. But I suppose then, to you now listening to it, I'm guessing it wasn't a shock when the plug was pulled on the program, really, then?
No, I mean, what happened in 2003, end of 2002, we'd thrown another driver in the car for GB, a really good driver, Justin Dale, to try and help us out. And unfortunately, he had to put some good times in. He didn't come out, and we had Francois. So the new management decided that they'd step out of the 2003 championship and develop this car. So I went. I actually went out to America to help Vermont Sports Car running Mitsubishi's against ProDrive. So it was. To be fair, you could see. I didn't see really during 2003 why we'd improved. There were some things that happened on some tests which were like shocking, and you know, for me, you either do it properly or you don't do it. And it became quite clear at the end of 2003 into the start of 2004, it was shockingly bad.
Was that the period where, because, you know, Ryan obviously was doing bits and pieces then, and we've since seen, you know, the stillborn, I suppose, livery of the Abu Dhabi livery. Was that period then where it was going to run as a private team?
Yeah, the Abu Dhabi came. I got to the start of 2004, and I went to help the boys doing the running in for Monte Carlo, because there was that much friction in the suspension at the back that they had to put 100 kilometres mileage on the cars on every corner. It was stupid stuff. The front uprights were still flexing and causing pad knockoff. The gearbox had a really bad vibration at 3,000 revs because the way they tried to lightweight the actual inner casings. And that's before we even start the season. We got into 2004, and we were having to get the scrutineer to come to us after the shakedown, because we'd actually have transmission leaks because of the way the transmissions were vibrating. So I decided from, I think it was May, I gave my notice, which shocked a few people. So I was expected to leave straight away on garden leave, and I ended up being there for 5 months to find a replacement. But I just didn't agree with the way it was, and it never went anything. But the thing was, you could physically see we'd had a lot of glory times, and we'd had, you know, we'd won stuff when we shouldn't have won stuff because we never had the budgets to compete with Ford or Toyota or Subaru. And now we had the budget, but we were just chucking it down. We might as well just started up a bonfire in the car park and chuck money at it. It was that bad. So I decided that one day I woke up on a Thursday and said, that's it, finished. I need to move on after 13 years. It was a hard decision, but I'm glad I did it.
And that's when the trip to, obviously, there was a great battle going on over in the States at the time with Vermont Sports Car. I think, I can't remember, I'm sure, wasn't MEN involved with Vermont Sports Car and that program as well? And Pro Drive were doing stuff out there. So there was the blue and red were going toe to toe once again.
Yeah, and the strange thing was I got friendly with Mark Lovell, who's a brilliant guy, same as Richard, perfect, brilliant, brilliant guy. And he was out there competing for Subaru with Ramon Alagaman against David Higgins. It was a really good series, a really good battle. The Mitsubishi was basically a Group M Plus car. And Subaru had taken, a Step 1 World Rally car, and it was a really good fight. And we did some trick stuff with tyres, and we were clever with a few things. And Subaru's, they could have much more power out there. The open pass allowed you to run, you know, probably further on than what the actual transmissions were capable of, and Subaru had an Achilles heel with the transmissions failing. But yeah, we won the championship out there in 2003. But it was I met Lance Smith of Vermont Sports Car, who was running it locally for Mitsubishi and MEM against ProDrive, and that was the start of the relationship with Lance that led to me going out to America in the end of 2005. But in the middle, I had the pleasure of working with RED in Wigness, which was for me was a, even though it was a small team, working with Neil Gatt and the Roberts boys, that it was a great traditional name, RED. All the drivers had driven for it, so I enjoyed my 18 months with them running. We ran two World Rally Car Subarus with some ProDrive support for Olsbergs, but that was really interesting.
I knew there was an RED connection, Ryan Champion. I knew. Thank you, Derek. Thanks for getting us there, because I thought I was going mad, because I can remember us talking about this a long time ago. I was thinking, I'm sure Derek did something, but I must admit, I thought it was way back when. But I'm guessing the Vermont thing obviously was Vermont's Subaru a bit further down the line, and that's when you hook up finally with Ken Block.
Yeah, and what happened there was we obviously knew Lance from 2003, and Lance is a fantastic guy. He's his heart's in rallying. He wants to do the right thing, you know. But he became a friend as well as I worked for him. And I was working with RED. We'd done from 2004 to the end of 2005. He phoned me up and he goes, "What are you doing next year?" And the Allsburg thing with RED was you know, whether they're going to do it, whether they weren't going to do it. I said to him, "Oh, I'm not sure, quite sure at the moment." So I've got this young lad called Travis Pastrana that Japan want to try and in the background teach him the ropes and bring him to World Championship. Are you interested? So I went across there 2 weeks later to Lance, and we did a deal straight away to join Vermont Sports Car and to help Travis, and started work on Lance's budget straight away that following afternoon. And then, but at the time, Ken Block was just sold DC, and he was a sponsor of Travis. And he was, you know, he was into running. He wanted to be the number two driver. So going into 2006, I had Travis, and we had Ken Block. And it was like cartoon characters, to be fair, to start off with. The first test we had was interesting. The boys got, both of them, brilliant at understanding where the grip was on the road. But to get them there and to set the car up, I sat with both of them and we discussed it and went through it and we made some changes to the cars. And the first few events were like kind of like, you know, it was a brilliant atmosphere between them, two of them. And basically, but they were showmen. And basically they were going out to give a show to the spectators, which was fine. And but we got two events in, and all of a sudden we went to the third or fourth event, and both of them were like, "Well, okay, so how do you improve the car to try and beat Ken?" And Ken equipment go, "How do you improve the car to try and beat Travis?" And they started to be like finishing the stages were like a second apart, so they were very, very close straight away in 2006, and that led to a switch of tactics where we'd done the first two events, and you'd drive down the road and you'd try and get within close to the stages and still stay on legal with the actual regulations, but listen to them on the radio, and they were betting each other, you know, who's going to win each other on this stage, and they're like, "What?" And then it was like, "Okay, how many donuts are you going to do at the spectator point?" How's that? And I saw red, and I got on the radio. I said, "Hey, boys," I said, "no one's doing any donuts. You're going to drive through the stage. You're going to bring the car to the end of the stage." And it went quiet. But that's what they're into. And then halfway through 2006, it got quite competitive. And one of the great things with that first year was we were really successful when some of the well-known drivers out there were coming up to me and telling me, you know, "When we catch Travis or when we catch Ken, tell him to pull over." And it never worked out. But we did. That's when X Games started in the August. And we had the pleasure of working with Colin McRae, who came across to join Ken and Travis. And also Tanner Faust was our fourth driver. So we ran four drivers on that event.
Wow. Wow. That is the image, of course, Colin rolling. It's so well documented now, isn't it? It's kind of, you know, the reaction of Travis of seeing Colin roll.
The story behind it was that we went and did some stages in the hills, and the format worked out really well. And when we started the event, you know, the strange thing is, it's a strange thing with rallying. You're probably aware of this, but I'd obviously known Alistair McRae, and I'd known Jimmy for a long time, and Jimmy almost classed him, "How are you doing, son?" when he meets you, and you know, adopted the family, but I never had much to do with Colin, apart from saying good morning to him or hello. That was about it, even though we competed against him at Mitsubishi for all that time. And when he came, he phoned me up and said, "Oh, you know, is this deal possible with Vermont?" And I said, "Yeah, for sure it is." And we got chatting, and I'd known him to talk to a bit from RED when we almost put the deal together to run him at Skoda, but he came across, and I said to Colin, and Colin had a bad time at Citroën at the time. You know, Citroën weren't really good with him. You could see it from the outside that they were favouring either drivers who were more PlayStation drivers and throwing the car around. And I said to Colin, look, I said, it's a small team, Vermont sports car. You know, everybody, and I mean everybody, will do anything, you know, whether it's sweeping up or whatever. So, you know, really in a nice way saying we can't afford any prima donnas. And he came in and he enjoyed it, and he got to the shakedown, he turned the plate, and it cost me a $200 fine with the organisers. I wasn't impressed with that. So we did the first stage, and Colin said to me, I'm going to take it easy over the first one. He says, but the boys won't get anywhere near me. I said, okay, fair enough, no problem. And it was really close to the service area. He came on the radio, and I was passing times to Travis and Ken. I think Colin was third on the road or something. And I said, what's your time, Colin? And he dropped some time to Travis. And then he came on the radio. I'll never forget it. He goes, oh, boys, you're going to make me work for my living then, are you? And there was quite a big fight over those six stages. And then at the end of those six stages, they divided the stage times by 10, and it closed up the gap to everybody going into the stadium event. But on the stadium event, I was giving split times to Colin, and we were he was quite adamant that he'd be quite clear. And I said, well, do you want me to give you split times? No, I think you're right. And then the last minute, he said, okay, we'll take split times. And as he went through, he was minus one, so 1 second quicker than Travis, about 300 metres, 400 metres from going into the stadium, the jump into the stadium. As he got into the entrance of the stadium, he dropped a second to him. So as he went into the stadium, I gave Nicky the time of zero, which was like, oh, my God, they've dropped a bit of time. So he pushed and he rolled. But it's an iconic finish to the event. And I think many people have seen it on the internet and YouTube, whatever. But the end of that event, we had a team dinner, and Colin came to me afterwards, took me aside and said that he loved the atmosphere, the event, and he wanted to carry on, and he wanted to go across to America the following year.
Wow.
Yeah, I was just going to ask that. So did that then lead to sort of discussions with Colin to try and carry that on?
Yeah, you know, we did the second year, and then tragically the accident happened, and we got to a point just before the accident that I think he was quite surprised on how the American side, we were very clever at leveraging the image rights, and you know, the sponsorship is at a different level and the approach is at a different level, and we've got a super agent who I'm adamant that Jerry Maguire the film was actually taken off our agent Steve Astafan from WNG. He's brilliant. He's just like Jerry Maguire. He leverages the sponsors but gives the return on them. And I think Colin could see that there was more of an option of making some more money out in America. And a strange thing happened on the second year when we were at X Games. We would do autograph lines, and we'd give away big posters, and people have something they could take home and put on the wall with a signature on it. And it was like a really good return for the spectators that came out, and they got a handshake, much, much more than what we've seen on World Championship in the past. And Colin was doing some autographs, and I said to him, you know, Colin's computer game was successful even in America at that point. Do you want to take have a picture or get a signed poster from Colin? And he actually didn't believe Colin was real. His concept was that it was just made up for a computer game. And Colin and me looked at each other and like, we have to change this whole philosophy. So I think the sad thing about it all was I think he was more into doing more in America the following year, and we never got to that, unfortunately.
Now, you talk about high profile, you talk about raising awareness. You've just spent several years on probably one of the highest profile programs anywhere in the world that involves a car. Tell us a little bit about being involved with Gymkhana.
It's basically evolved. I mean, the first one was around with Subaru. It was a Subaru around this year's airfield. But what's happened now is that it's obviously become its own franchise. it's extremely successful. But what I will say to you is that what people see of an end product is nothing to what is required in the background to make it happen. And I think that's driven the success of the Gymkhana series with, you know, you can't just, you know, people think we film it with like two GoPros and someone stood on the corner. You know, that's not how it happens. There's 30 or 40, you know, well, there's 120 people on the actual set, but there's probably, I think the last one we're doing is 16 to 18, but we've had it to 30 different camera positions going, you know, to get the angle and to get the content and the quality of filming. It's a massive thing. So it's evolved from a small operation to a much bigger operation. And we've actually been working with Amazon this year, and there's an Amazon file, a Gymkhana file's coming out in November, which is when we release Gymkhana 10, which is our biggest Gymkhana we've ever done. Hopefully we don't do that again, because it's been an interesting one. But the idea is to show warts and all what actually happens to get us to these filming and what happens on set, and it doesn't always go the way people think, and it's difficult and the conditions are hard. But they've followed us since last year, and I think people, well, it'd be interesting to see what people's reactions are, but we have shown it warts and all.
Fantastic. Derek, I'm really aware of how much time we've taken from you, and we've haven't even really covered the stuff you're doing with Ken and World Championship, and of course Ken coming back to the World Championship. Would you mind doing something with us again in the not too distant future?
Yeah, absolutely, no problem.
Because this has just been a joy. We you know, obviously we didn't know where we were going to go, but our fans love this stuff, to be honest with you. And I think we could probably do about a 4-hour podcast with you, but I'm just really aware of how much time we've took with you. But if we could do part two, maybe in a month or two's time, maybe after Ken's come back to WRC as well, perhaps we can have a little chat about that.
Yeah, that'd be good timing.
Perfect. Listen, thank you so much, Derek Dornacy. Thank you for coming on Absolute Rallying, folks. We'll be back after this break.
This is Absolute Rally, powered by the Kielder Works team. Cordless tools tailored for the world of motorsport. Developed from hands-on knowledge that you only get in the service park, not the boardroom. The range of Kielder cordless impact wrenches are designed to be compact, lightweight, feel good, and crucially, get the job done. Kits are available for less than £160. Plus, exclusively for Absolute Rally listeners, use discount code RALLY for 10% off at www.kielder.co. Simply search Kielder Tools online.
Welcome back to the final section of Absolute Rally. Obviously, we haven't had the sound of the rally car thing yet, have we? Rye obviously put out some pictures of his particular mug. Obviously, hopefully the clue made sense now. The guys at Kielder put out their fleet of mugs, which is brilliant. We've got a meeting with Kielder guys in our little break. There will be some more mugs. But we're going to try and think of something a little bit different of how you win the mugs. What is quite nice is that people do want to buy them. So maybe they will go up in value. I don't know. So, boys, have you all got your mugs now?
Yep.
Yeah.
You know.
No, Rye's getting his personally delivered by the MD of Kiel. Take notes of him.
Didn't you send a picture with it yesterday, Rye?
No.
It's a different
one. Tony wasn't paying attention, was he?
No.
He really didn't pay attention to the point of the picture of that mug.
No. Oh, sorry. No, sorry. There you go. Listen, boys, I'm going to very quickly do my any other business. And if I trod on anybody's toes, I'm sorry, but I'm just really conscious of time. I did the coverage of the Promenade Stages, the live stream coverage last weekend, talking to myself. I never thought I'd miss you boys, but I genuinely did miss you boys for two days of talking to myself. But Pete Smith was there with his new acquisition, which was a stunning Mark II Escort, and it was great to see Pete. But what is, again, which is just so impressive is obviously he's supporting Matt Edwards with his double title challenge. Matt secured now BTRDA, but one driver that he has supported with his R2 program is a guy from, I think, from your neck of the woods, isn't he, right? Matt Smith. And Peter's gave him the R5 Fiesta to go and have a run on the track rod with, which I just think is amazing. You know, what an amazing gesture. I thought the R2 gesture was amazing, let alone doing it with an R5. And good on good on Pete, and, you know, putting so much into rallying at the moment, and it was great to see him last weekend also. A couple of bits and pieces. Manx government, we talked about the Manx before. Manx government saying that they will reimburse marshals, etc., that are out of pocket, whether it's flights or hotels and things like that, to try and soften the blow of the cancellation of Manx. Great gesture. I think it's the least that all concern can do, really, because obviously without marshals we'd be absolutely screwed. And just the story that about Petter Solberg, about what's been going on with Petter this year and what he's had to go up against, I'm sure you've all seen it, boys, but the fact that we're hearing the story, I'd like to think now he's come through the other side, and it'd be great, you know, we talked about it before, it'd be great if we see him in a rally car again this year, if the R5 Polo, that'd be great, and obviously alongside his Rallycross program. So that's my end of the business. Done. So we'll go to yours, Jack Bennion.
Oh, thank you. A couple of very quick thank yous. First, thank you to Kielder for my mug. It's very nice, and had a good pre-weekend brew from it before I left, so thanks very much for that. Thank you to all you guys, my co-hosts, for every single one of you text me before my run on Sunday, which was very motivational. And a big thank you to all the Absolute Rally listeners that donated to the brilliant Sporting Memories Network charity that I've been raising money for the Great North Run, which I've not talked about very much, I know. But thank you. It kept me going, and I'm very grateful to all the listeners. I was going to talk about Matt Smith, but I won't, because you've done it already. So not in reserve, because I also wanted to say well done to Andrew Gallagher, who won the Scottish Rally Championship at the weekend. We talked about the Galloway Hills Rally, and that was the event. It was won dominantly by David Bogie. He seems to win every Scottish Rally Championship event he enters at the minute. But Andrew finished towards the back end of the top 10, but did enough to win the championship after Donny McDonald had a problem on the first or the second stage. And Andrew Gallagher, interestingly, is the first son of a champion in the Scottish Rally Championship to win a championship. And his dad, Drew, won 4 championships in the 70s and 80s. So well done to Andrew Gallagher for his championship in a very cool early 2000s focused WRC.
With Jay Nicol alongside.
Yeah.
Sorry, yep. Not only that, that was Mark Higgins' British championship winning Focus.
Ah, I didn't know it was that exact car.
I think one ES when Mark won the championship in 2005.
There you go. Well, as you spoke up, Ryan Champion, can we have yours, please?
You can. What happened 21 years ago today?
I was 22 years old.
Right. Anything else?
Probably had a cup of tea.
So what year was it, Trevor Agnew?
97. British Championship. Mark Higgins won the British Championship.
He did. On which rally?
Manx.
In the Manx, after obviously. He took a wheel off.
Yeah, that was the famous end to the Manx rally, which we've talked about a few times with the battle of the kit cars. Martin Rowe taking, I think it was his first win, wasn't it, on the Manx that year, and Mark fighting him for the win, taking a wheel off, but still winning the British Championship. So we've just mentioned it's not running this year, unfortunately, but the Manx always ran at this kind of time. If we go a little bit further back to 1991, Colin McRae actually took his first victory on the Manx International today in the Rothmans Legacy. And also going back a bit further to 1986, Tony Pond took his fourth victory in the Works 6R4.
There you go. Trevor Agnew.
Trevor Agnew, you rolled on that 97 event, didn't you, in the Civic?
We did, yeah.
With Neil Weirden.
Was, yeah.
Applied knowledge. Thanks. There. Applied knowledge.
Sorry, Tony. Continue.
No, that's fine. Trevor Agnew, you're any other business.
My any other business. So on the back of what we did with the coaching series a few months ago now, we did 10 of them. I'd just be really interested to find out, certainly with a lot of comments at the time, people seeing the benefit of it and understanding it and thinking, okay, good idea. I just wondered, did anybody actually do anything with it? Usual things in these scenarios where you start to break down the percentages, and very few people will actually write down some goals and then start using them. So I'd just be interested to find out if anybody has achieved anything concrete in rallying on the back of what we did.
Okay, that would be good. That would be good. Well, to be fair, Trev, you did say you could use it for any aspect of life. So
of course,
maybe not. Yeah,
I did. While I was training for my run, I wrote down a distance that I wanted to reach each week, and I attempted to reach it.
Okay, was that in the back of what we were talking about then?
Yeah.
Oh, fair enough.
You know, I'll stretch.
Any other testimonials would be great. Just because of the comments we were receiving at the time were great. I get it. You know, I've had lots of feedback over the years, and it's good just to have people, you know, doing things a little bit different, a bit more structure to it, and doing it stage by stage.
Just one final thing there. Trev, you just reminded me, you saw it on Twitter as I did. Lewis Moyer put a fantastic video on Twitter this week. He's got a big week coming up, a major operation, but he was in very positive spirits ahead of his hospital visit next week.
Yeah. I think we shared that as well. So there you go. So boys, and this is our penultimate episode of this particular season. We've got Rally Turkey, which of course we will be looking back on next week. So folks, I hope you've enjoyed the podcast. I hope you've enjoyed having all four of us. It does feel a bit like hard work when we're all here. And you know, people showing off because there's other people there and everything else. But you know, there you go. I hope you enjoyed it. If you are enjoying the podcast, please, please, please do share it about. Let your friends know, let your rally friends know and everything else. And the people who did tweet me, because they were listening to or watching the live stream, they recognised my voice. They thought I was one of your friends, Jack Bengen. I got some comments. Someone thought it was actually Paul O'Neill.
Excellent. Yeah, brilliant.
Yeah, so there you go. Anyway, so that's it. So that's it for this week. Folks, we will be back at the same time, same place, in your little podcast hole, supported by Kielder. Of course, we wouldn't be here without them this time next week.
Absolute Rally, powered by the Kielder Works team. Spread the word and download the podcast every week.